You are now listening to the Claim It Podcast with me, your host, Trisha Huffman, also known as your Joyologist. My hope is that by listening to this podcast, you feel a little bit less alone on this wild and windy journey of being human. You see that your feelings of being enough, worthy, successful, fulfilled are not out there somewhere, but they're always a part of you. And that by you loving and accepting and appreciating who you are, where you are right now, that is what hopefully will propel you to do the things you do want to do and give yourself a shit ton more compassion on this wild journey of life. On today's episode, I had such an amazing time talking to Valerie June. She is a Grammy-nominated artist, a poet, an author. Oh my gosh, hearing about her life journey was incredible. She's been hailed by the New York Times as one of America's most intriguing, fully formed new talents, and she has an incredible journal book coming out this week, Light Beams, a workbook for being your badass self. I mean, of course, I love that. A workbook for being your badass self? Yes. All right. I love talking to Valerie. I know that you're going to love her, her heart, her journey. And here, here we go. I do this so often. I would really love for you to hit that follow button, subscribe, and also to share the episode. Tag me on social media at Claim It Podcast, @_TrishaHuffman. Tag the guest and leave a review. Reviews really help the podcast become more discoverable. So that other people can be claiming their lives too. Here we go. So I love starting with teenage years, but you can go even before that. But I just feel like teenage years can be such an interesting time of like trying to figure out who we are in the world. And there can be this pressure from us and also outside world of like, what are you going to be when you grow up and do with the rest of your life? So I don't know if anything you want to share earlier that, or just what was life like for you as a teenager?
Oh, well, as a teenager, I lived in the middle of the country and we didn't really have any friends besides my siblings. I have an older brother, a younger brother, and two little sisters. So there's five of us. And we lived in a garage that my parents had built because my father had a construction company and they bought this 10 acres of land in the country, and they had this dream that they would build their dream house one day, and they got their architect to create the plans, and they were saving for it. And so we lived kind of far from you know, any kids we would have been friends with at school, and our parents were very strict Christians, so going to spend the night at people's houses, they would be like, well, they dance, or, you know, stuff like that. You can't go. There was always a reason for us not to be able to go somewhere. So we kind of made up games out there in the country, and we, you know, picked up crawdads and frogs and feral cats and puppies, and they got dropped off out there, and we just made friends with nature growing up. And yeah, once I, you know, got to be 14, the shop burned down. It was a shop that had giant doors so that my dad could get bulldozers and tractor trailer trucks and dump trucks that he had in there. And he would, you know, be able to work on the equipment or store the equipment that they used to build churches and things that they were building. But it would be on the land, so the house would be on the other side and the shop would be over here. And the way they built the shop was that half of it, not the side that you could get tractors in, was an apartment style, and the kids had the upstairs and my parents in the kitchen and everything was downstairs. And so when we were coming home from school one day, we saw this giant cloud of smoke in the miles away. And we were like, what in the world is that? Because the closer we got to our house, the more smoke we saw. And we got there and our house was burning down. And we lost everything. And the money that they had been saving was in there and it got burnt up and just all kinds of stuff. It was just crazy. So we ended up moving into a motel and we stayed there for a while, and the church people actually were the ones who came together and gave us so many things like clothes, food, things we needed, because we were lost everything. And then a bid for a job came in for my dad, and it was to build a church, and they gave him a great advance on the job. And because we were homeless, he was like driving by one day, and there was an auction of a house that was right down the street from where we lived in the country. And he stopped by and put a bid on it, and he got it. It was right there on the spot kind of auction. And they were like, he won't be able to come up with the money. And he had the money. And so he dropped the money on it, and we moved into a house, a real house, not a garage. And their dream, though, of building their own house never came. But the house that they got was very similar to the dream house. So I learned about manifestation, and I learned that it doesn't always look like you want it to look, you know, but you keep the vision of what you wish for, and there might be loss, but it will happen, you know?
So growing up before the fire happened and like living in the garage sort of thing too, like, did you just think like that's what life, you know what I mean? It was like, even though you knew your parents had a dream for a house, but too, since you like lived further out and you weren't going to friends' houses, like, were you guys just like, yeah, this is where we live. Awesome. Like, did you have any sort of idea of like, oh, we live in a garage? You know what I mean? Like, I'm wondering if, because if you might have been not seeing other people living in houses, or if you knew like, oh, I can't wait till we get out of this place.
It was a lot like, I can't wait till we get out and okay. I finally have enough money to build a house. Cause I invited like maybe one friend over, but I was really embarrassed to invite friends over because it was a cinder block garage. And I was like, you know, everyone else lives in a basic normal house. Why can't we too? You know, but they were dreamers, and that was part of building a dream, that they would have the shop and the compound of this acreage and grow food and all of that. And so now, though, as a musician, I look back and I'm like, I would kill for that shop because I could turn the music up, crank it as loud. The neighbors are 10 acres away at least. And I would just rip, you know, and not have any trouble. And we would take showers outside and all kinds of stuff, and nobody was around. You know, you could do whatever you wanted. It was cool.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's too, it's so interesting because you never know what could make you, because you could have, I didn't know. I was wondering if you were like, this is awesome how we live. I love it. You know what I mean? You never know. And then to looking at other people's stuff, that was where we can look like, oh no, something wrong with what I have because they have this, right? Like, but you could have been like, oh wow, this is a really cool setup. We get to live in this cool thing. But so that when you said that you learned the, sort of about manifestation with your parents, and they were saving for that dream house, and then even their money, not only the belongings, but their money burned that they were saving too. So like really lost everything. But then getting that contract and then getting that house, was that something that your parents did like sort of talk to you about? Like, and I don't know if you were raised Christian, if they would have used the term manifestation, but like, were they saying sort of like those sorts of things? Like, look, you know, we got what we wanted, or that, did they sort of imply that to you? Or are you looking back, looking at, oh, look, they manifested it?
It's me looking back and knowing the terminology for what they were actually living. But my father was a visionary. He was a dreamer. And to be an African-American man in the South and have a small business, and, you know, there's a certain amount of dreaming that has to happen, because a lot of doors are closed to you based on just you waking up every day and looking like you look. So he had a lot of struggles that he faced and a lot of dreams that he had to like be like, nope, I'm not taking no for an answer. I have a vision. I have what I want in my mind and I'm going for it. I'm going to own my own business. I'm going to like give people in my community jobs and lift up my community and opportunities. And I can do this. I don't have to work for anybody. I don't have to be on the farm or the plantation or whatever the mindset would have been. You know, it's a shifting of the mind and believing that he could. And my mother being like a great supporter And to the point that sometimes when times were hard and they were breaking into a penny jar, she was like, steal game. she was like, let me go find a rich man and get out of here.
And in the area you lived in, and even that church that you belonged to and that helped you out, was that primarily, was it Black? Was it white? Was it mixed? Like, were you in an area?
As a very young kid, from the time I was born until 12, 10 or 11, somewhere in there. I don't know. I can't keep up with these years. I was going to a predominantly Black church. So that means there were probably 500 African-Americans and maybe 5 white people or any other race. And it was East Jackson Church of Christ. And then when I got older, about 10, my parents found the land and we moved to the country, which is closer to North Jackson Church of Christ. And there are very few people of color living out there. And at first we drove all the way across town back to the east to go to church with our own people. But then my parents were like, why are we doing this to ourselves? We're driving all the way across town. It takes that much extra time for us to get there. And there's a North Jackson Church of Christ right down the street. The only difference is there are 500 white people and us 7 Black people. So we walked in, and the first day we walked in, the church is in mid-song singing, oh, and they all went, oh, basically like, but that was not any, you know, it was just this moment of, oh, and then after that, we're part of the family. So years now that we've been a part of that church, and my mother still goes, and they have been a part of the family. Father passed, my dad, and we had the service there. My sister got married and we had the wedding there, and you know, the way they supported us during the fire and different things in life. And though I believe many different things than I was raised, it is still so comforting to see and feel the hearts of the people that I went to church with and know that they are so happy and thrilled for me with my music and the things that I do, and they support and they have good hearts and loving energy from both the Black church and the white church. And without them, I wouldn't know how to sing, because it was a church where there were no instruments. So everyone sang all together. And in the Black church, everyone sang more from like a low place, like, mm-hmm. And in the white church, people sang the same songs, but it was like, ah! And I was like, damn, what a culture shift, you know? So I had to learn the songs again from a low place. And so now when I sing those two ways, but not much in the middle, you know?
That's so funny. Yeah, I was curious because, again, with your dad and having these beliefs of, you know, building his own business. And I was like, oh, was that even more so like he was in a white community and like, let's do this than primarily Black community? So I was just interested about that. So what happened then? So then you're living in that in a house. they got their almost dream house. And what happened? And when? And yeah, so you said that's when you got into music. But is that just because you were singing at church? Was any part of you like, I am going to be a singer, I'm going to be a musician? And like, when of that? Or like, yeah, like what happened leading up to high school ending? And where did you think you were going next?
Well, I really like wanted to be a singer ever since I was riding side by my dad in the dump trucks and Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody or Tracy Chapman's Fast Car came on the radio. I'd be like, singing at the top of my lungs, like, ooh, one day I want to sing. But I knew I had a different voice, that my voice was not commercial or radio friendly, so to say. And so I never believed that it could be possible for me, really. And my dad had that construction company, but he also had a music promotion company. So he would promote shows. And so he used the money that he would get from construction to work with the other dream, which was music. So he would promote shows for like Prince or the gospel shows or R&B shows, stuff like that. So
like, no big deal. I thought you were going to say like local acts. You're like Prince.
No, it's like when Prince was first starting too. Like,
okay, he was just promote shows on the side for Prince. Like,
what? He was just getting going, so he wasn't Prince big time money man. But I guess he always knew talent. So at that point,
was your dad a musician too? Like, or he just always loved music? Like, yeah, like what led him to then also taking that on? Like, was he someone that he wanted to do it himself, but didn't, but was like, let me get involved this way, or just really loved music?
He just loved music. He loved it. And his brothers played. They play guitar and bass, but he didn't play. And he used to help them get shows. And so as he got older, this is when they were teenagers. As he got older, he started to want to book bigger acts. And so he started to get into music promotion. And it was really important to him to bring people to our community that normally wouldn't come. You know, they would go to Nashville or to Atlanta or Memphis, but they wouldn't come to Jackson, Tennessee, which was a smaller area. And so, he wanted to bring things to the community because a lot of people in the community didn't have the money to go to Nashville for a show or wherever it is. So that was kind of his motivation for it, was ways of bringing the community together and being passionate about loving music. He was so musical. It was on all day and all night. And I was just be like, wow, he loves music more than anybody in the family, you know? So that was what drove him to do it. But having five kids, he was like, I got to make money and pay bills. I can only do shows for when I have enough to do it. And so then he has started the construction company and started doing that.
But so you always felt like you wanted to be a singer, but like, oh, that's not possible for me with my voice. Like, that would be amazing, but not for me. Is that what you were feeling like younger ages?
Yes. But that didn't stop me from singing. I sang all the time. And my whole family, we're all singers, we're musical, and we sang on the way to school, sang on the way to church, on the way to grands. We sang at church. And so I sang for 18 years, and my grandfather gave me a guitar when I was 15, and I promised him I'd learn how to play it. It was a guitar that had been in the closet of the house that we would go to grand and granddad's for holidays or whatever. And this guitar, you can never touch this guitar. Now, y'all kids, get out of that closet. You can't touch that guitar now. Well, I had an art teacher at school who played acoustic guitar while we did art. And I fell in love with the sound of acoustic guitar. And I wanted one. And I knew that granddad had one in the closet. And so the next time we went there for holiday, I begged from morning to night, please, granddad, let me have the guitar. And finally, my grandmother got so tired that night, and she said, Clyde, if you don't give that girl that guitar, you ain't played that guitar in 30 years. And she said, you don't even know how to play that guitar. And I said, oh, thank you, Grant. And so he gave it to me. And I tried to play it. It was really hard. And I was a cheerleader and I liked chasing all the football players. And so I gave up. But then years later, I started to sit down with it and pick it out. Just pick it out. And I said, I promised granddad I'd learn. So I have to learn in my lifetime, even if I'm 80 before I can play a full song. So I did.
And what did you end up learning while you were still in high school?
No, I was in my early 20s when I learned.
So then when you graduated high school, were people around you were you in a community that was like, you go to college next? Or was it you get a job next? Or like, what was your life in that transition of, okay, high school's ending?
Well, it was really kind of dark. My boyfriend at the time was about 5 or 6 years older than me, and he played guitar, and he moved to Memphis, and so that was the big city. So when I left high school, they were all like, go to college, do something with your life. But I couldn't, because they didn't have their situation together for me to get loans, and I had no credit of my own, so I had to just go to work. And so I moved in with my boyfriend in Memphis, and it broke my mother's heart that I left. She said, you living in sin, you're going to go to hell. And she didn't talk to me for like 2 years. Nothing. And so I was 18 on my own, no money, not anything. And if my dad were to reach out to talk to me, then he was going to get kicked out. So there was nobody. Okay. And so I got jobs. I just got a lot of jobs because living as a single woman with no money, like you cannot pay rent with one job. I had two or three jobs. So I worked waitress in the morning, coffee shop in the afternoon, clean houses at night, you know, and on and on. And so I moved to Memphis. I did that for a couple of years and I make like lists of things I needed. Yeah, as I was working the jobs, we had a roommate who was going to Memphis College of Art. And when I was thinking about going to college, back when I thought that they could, you know, show their whatever their income was so I could get loans, then I wanted to go to art school. And so I would look at like Savannah College of Art or Memphis College of Art or Parsons or whatever and like be like, okay, I'm going to apply for these. But when I found out that I couldn't apply for loans, then I was just like, well, I can't go to art school. And living with an artist who was in art school and having a bunch of friends who were his friends that were in art school, I'm really glad I didn't go to art school because what they did was they went, it cost a lot of money, they had a lot of debt, and they got out and they didn't have jobs. So they had to go teach. And that wasn't why they went to art school. They went to art school because they wanted to be artists. And
you know what? That is so true. College period is expensive, but I had some friends that went to like art school. Like I remember I went to Columbia College in Chicago and one of my friends from high school went to like the Art Institute of Chicago. And her tuition was probably like, mine was not cheap. And hers was probably like four times. And like, yeah, they're charging you so much money to go to art school when it's so hard to make money as an artist. Like, wait a minute, what is the reasoning?
I know. And so I did the math and I was like, look, if I go to school, I need to go to school for something I can make some money at. And so because my heart was in art and it was in music, I said, well, neither one of these is going to put me into anything but debt first. So let me just stack some cash and make a record. And once I get that record made, if it doesn't get picked up by a label or I'm not able to figure out a way to live from my art, then I'll go to school and I won't go for art or music. I'll go for something that can actually pay my bills. And so I said, well, I'm going to have to get another job because if I'm trying to save some money, how much do I need? And I had a goal in my mind that I would save like $50,000 so that I could make the record, but also I could promote it, you know? And my dad being a promoter, I kind of knew numbers that I would need to promote it and to tour.
Psst, Trisha here. Did you sign up for my daily text messages yet? I am loving sending these and the people who are on that list are really loving receiving them every single day, every single day, every single day, not just Monday through Fridays, not just when I feel like it. I send out a message that comes right to your text messages. And it doesn't matter if you have an international number, whatever. The message comes right to your text message so you don't have to get distracted, confused, lose it. And they are different prompts, notes of inspiration, loving nudges, reminders to do things. It might be like, hey, pick out a song you love today. It might be like, hey, how can you sprinkle some kindness today? Every Monday, you get a new affirmation mantra with a mantra screensaver to save on your phone. There's voice memos. It's really, really fun. And again, I know there are so many ways to access inspiration and motivation these days, but there's also a lot of distractions out there. So have it pop right into your phone. And then, of course, you have them all in that text message feed. You can scroll back and see these old ones as soon as you join. Obviously, then you get the rest of them from until you quit. Try it, yourjoyologist.com/text. You can use code JOY3 to get $3 off the first 3 months. You can cancel at any time. And it's just like a Netflix subscription. You know, you can join and then cancel right away and you'll still get the text messages for a month and they'll just stop sending exactly 1 month after you joined. So why not try it out, right? yourjoyologist.com/text. They are meant to connect you with you, remind you what matters, give you space for reflection, and into your heart and out of your head.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Besides your dad, because even how much it cost to make a record, like, did you have any, was that all from your dad as well? Or did you know people that were making their own music at the time? Or?
Yeah. So when I moved to Memphis, I met a bunch of musicians because I worked at a coffee shop where they would all come for their coffee. So I served like writers and artists and musicians. And they would tell me, I would be like, well, you just made a record. How much did it cost? Oh, what studio did you use? And I'd be like, okay.
So you were like collecting all of this information.
Yeah. And write it all in my journal 100 times. How many hours did it take you? Oh, it's going to take me 50 hours. Da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, like how much did it cost to package it? You know, all of it. So I did all that and made some records on the computer at home with my ex, who was a guitar player. And I didn't play anything. All I did was sing. And then we just went to the store, got the jewel cases, burned the CDs, made the CDs, sold them out the trunk, and booked shows at cafes and bars. I'd go around to bars and be like, I walk in here. Who's booking this place? And then I'd meet the person who books, and I said, well, I got a band. Here's my CD. Will you book us? And they would say, we'll take a listen. And once we got a few gigs, then we started to get people coming. And as our following grew, then we got in bigger and bigger venues. And so, yeah.
Was that all songs that you wrote yourself? Were you ever doing covers or were you from the start making your own music?
Making my own, because my voice was very different. So it was hard for me to sing covers and sound like what happened on Beale Street, which was people would sing covers and they sound like the person who originally sang the cover. And it's very tourist. It's like Mustang Sally or Proud Mary or these songs. And people sound like freaking Tina or Aretha or whoever and B.B. King. And I just sound like me. So that was hard to try to sing, to get a cover gig was not going to work for me.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you just started writing songs, recording them, and it was just you and your boyfriend playing guitar on the tracks to begin with, too?
Yeah.
Like that was the CD that you're handing out to get booked?
Totally stripped down. I went to the lady who owned the cafe where I was working, and I said, y'all should have music at this cafe. And I was studying like Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell and that whole scene. And how they play at cafes and they have poetry and stuff. And she said, well, we've never done it. I said, well, would you mind if I organize a music night here? And she said, sure, if you want to do it, go for it. So I did. And because I served coffee to like 100 people that day or every day, I knew exactly what they wanted and had it ready for them before they got out the car. I would tell each person as I gave them the coffee, Friday night, I'm singing here. Friday night, I'm singing here. Come, come, come. It's going to be a free show and y'all can come. And they came. And it was my very first show. And people were like, okay. And they bought the CD and I made a lot of money. I made more than I'd made serving coffee. So I was like, I'm going to keep doing this. And it was like, you know, I eventually said, this has taken me way too long to get this $50,000. So I'm going to have to get another job. So I met a girl who hired independent artist to clean houses, and you just work for yourself. She would connect you to the person and you just work for yourself, and you would go and clean the house. And it was like $20-$30 an hour, and I was like, sure, I'll do that. So I would book all the hours that I could during that, during the day, started like 6 and worked till about 4 cleaning. I cleaned like anywhere from 3 to 4 houses. And then I also met another lady who owned a herb shop, and it was the cutest thing, and it's amazing, and it was right around the corner from the house. I could walk to it. And so I went around there and I got a job, and I learned all about herbs and natural healing and teas and tinctures, and I worked there for 7 years. I would get there at about 4 and work short hours till about 6. But it gave me like all the health things that I needed, where I didn't have to pay for those things, and things to self-care because I was working really hard. And after I got off there at 6, then I would transition and go play one of the bars. and stay out till like midnight, plan that, and then go to sleep, get up six, back, times 7 years. And I almost had enough money to make the record, and I got sick and my body shut down and I got diabetes and I couldn't get out of the bed for like months. And I was crawling to the bathroom, like crawling. My mother was like, you know, one day she came in the room because I had to move back in with them, and she threw down the yoga mat and she said, get up. You need to start doing whatever that stuff is you do, yoga. And I was like, okay. She said, because if you don't get up now, you're never going to get up. And I was weak. And I was weak for a long time, years. And I started getting my strength back. And I couldn't go back to the jobs. My body wouldn't let me. But my body did let me go to the gigs I had where I sat. And I just played. And all I had to do was sit there for like 30 minutes or an hour and play and give my little guarantee and my tips. And when it came to like, how am I going to pay bills? Well, I'd moved back in with my mom and dad because I'd had a divorce by then. That guy was gone. She instantly started talking to me again anyway as soon as we were married. And so the relationship.
Oh, so you did end up, you ended up marrying the boyfriend that you moved to Memphis with.
Yeah, I got married when I was 19.
Got so pretty quick.
It was mostly because of the relationship with my family that I, you know, just wanted to make sure that, you know, I didn't really care if I was living in sin because I don't think that way. But if that's what they needed, and I did love the man, then what I was going to do is just marry him. And we got married, and we played music together for a few years. And he never wanted to play music with me. He was a really great musician, and I heard his music, and I'd be in the other room washing dishes or painting or whatever. And as he would play, I hear voices. And so I would hear a voice singing to me. And I would bust in the room while he was playing, and I would start to sing what I was hearing. And he'd be like, get out of here. I'm writing a song. I said, well, I'm hearing a voice singing to me over your song, over your music. And so I would start singing what I was doing, and it fit with what he was playing. And so we wrote the song that way. And once we had 10 of them, that's when we made the record that we were selling at these gigs that I was booking. But he was resistant to it for most of the, it was about 4 years, and he didn't really want to play music with me. He wanted to play more soulful, funky music, and I was more folky. And
like, he wanted to do his own music. Mm-hmm. And was just sort of like, okay, I'll go along on your ride with you, but was really wanted to just do his own thing.
Right, which is fine. And that was a lot of lessons for me that I had to learn. And one of the lessons was when we stopped making music together and stopped playing together and being together, was that I got to learn how to play this guitar that Granddad gave me. So I was about 22 and I said, okay, G, C, D, E, learn these chords. Sit down. It's going to take me probably 40 years to learn, but I'm going to learn. And so between jobs, I would play for like 10 minutes, just get these calluses on my fingers, just play 10 minutes a day. And I developed this rule called the 10-minute rule. So whatever it is that I want to do with my life, I just do it in 10-minute increments, because it's too much pressure to say, oh, I'm going to be Jimi Hendrix tomorrow. So I just would be like, okay, 10 minutes. And if I'm not any better, in 5 years after doing 10 minutes a day, then I'll stop. And what happens though is that you sit down for 10 minutes and 10 minutes turns into 20, 30, 40, an hour, and you just did a full session. But when you don't have a lot of time and you are working a lot of jobs and life is pulling you so many directions, but you have a dream, then if you just give it 10 minutes, then it's like you're water in the sea, you know? And over time.
Yes.
it happens.
That's one of my favorite mantras, and I even have it like on some of the products I sell, is any minutes is more than no minutes. Baby steps are, or no, wait, any progress is more than no progress. Baby steps are, is progress. But the any steps is more than no minutes is something like I remind myself every single day about anything. Like, oh, I know it would feel better if I moved my body, but I don't want to. Like, okay, let me go take a walk for any minutes. Let me do yoga for any minutes. Let me, yeah. Okay, I'm writing this book. Oh, it's going to be so hard, or this. Like, we make everything so hard for ourselves. I'm like, okay, any minutes. Like, it's like, I'll sometimes be like, oh, I didn't get to work on that project again today. I guess I'll try tomorrow. And they'll be like, okay, no, you have 7 minutes until you leave to get your kids from school. 7 minutes. Go. And I'm like, oh, wow, I just had an amazing idea because I forced myself to just sit down for those 7 minutes. So I'm all about that. And I love that you took that tactic. And also, I love that you're like, break it into small pieces, but also like give yourself a long timeline, like 5 years. All right. I'll give up in 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
Of these 10 minute sessions.
That long timeline is key. I love any minutes. I love that. That's better than 10, because sometimes it is less than 10 that you have.
Yeah. Sometimes 10 minutes feels like too much. It's like any minutes. Okay.
I love that.
I want to ask too, like, since, you know, we touched on earlier, like you knew you wanted to sing early, but also like not me. Do you know, or do you remember like when you started to get inklings of like, yeah, why not try it? I mean, I know you said you moved to Memphis and we're seeing, you know, you're interested in art and music, didn't want to pay for those things to study, but like then, but you really went like all in. I mean, even though you're working all those other jobs to order to pay for an album to be recorded on your own, like, was there any like turning point or a few moments that you're just like, okay, if I'm gonna be here, then why am I not trying to be a singer? Or like, yeah, like what, where did that sort of shift?
When I started booking the shows and people, I developed such a crowd and support in Memphis, a following, that was what let me know that, yeah, I need to keep doing this. And then once I was on a trip and I was in Asheville, North Carolina, and I didn't have very much money for the trip. And I was like, I have a guitar. I'm just going to sit outside this health food store and play some songs and see if I can get some money in my tip jar. And I made like $100 in 30 minutes. And I was like,
wow,
you know what? Why am I cleaning houses? And then on top of that, one of the gigs that I booked after my divorce and I had learned a few chords myself was to go down to Helena, Arkansas and play at the King Biscuit Blues Festival, which is a huge festival. And they allow people to busk, but they also have main stages. So I went and I busked there when the festival happened for the whole day. You set up early in the morning and you just play music in the hot sun all day. And I'd be playing music in the hot sun, drinking whiskey like a dumbass, for real. But that's what old blues guys do, right? So I can do it. But my tip jar when I left there was like $1,500 in one day. And so I was like, you know what? I need to keep playing music, you know? But
that's incredible.
I didn't trust the path enough to quit my jobs. My body had to stop me, you know. But I could have made it, you know, even earlier. I could have stopped.
Yeah. That's incredible that they that festival lets people busk to, like, you know, to have that opportunity to set up. And that's really, really incredible. Because yeah, it's like it's so hard to get in front of, and it doesn't matter how talented you are, to get to the people that will say, yes, we will book this or whatever. You're like, yeah, you're like doing all of these things to put yourself out there, but like to have like how that gave you this confidence too, or like, oh, okay, these people just gave me their hard-earned money. Like, okay, like then like just people walking on the street like that, like, yeah, reminds, I guess I do have something perhaps. Like, that's really incredible. But even going further back, what even was inside you to try to do the shows, right? Because if you didn't think you had a chance, why would you even be putting yourself out there to go to like play at your coffee shop and stuff?
So part of what I learned in working at the coffee shop, there was a philosophy section and a spirituality section and books like Ask and It Was Given and anything, Thich Nhat Hanh, Oprah, anything, Richard Bach, anything would be in there. And the people who came into the coffee shop, many of them were spiritual. They were artists, and they believed in dreams still, you know, and magic and manifestation and what the world can be. And so I would look at the things that they were reading, and I'd be like, that guy's a writer and he's reading, or an actor and he's reading Ishmael. Let me read that, you know, and just reading Illusions or whatever it was. And then as I was reading and I was like, knew I had a dream, I started to get curious about, like, why am I in this body? Why am I here? And what is the purpose of life? I've always been curious about these things. And what does, like, how did I get here? And what does it look like after and stuff like that? And I just think that, like, all of it is a manifestation. And all of it is similar to a dream. And so understanding the anatomy of a dream, how does a dream come into being? How did I come into being? If I am a dream, if everything around me is a dream, like, how are dream? What's the material that makes up a dream? What's the stuff? And I wanted to understand that. So I said, well, the best way for me to understand that is to follow a dream. Let me see, what is a dream made up of? And that's, what's my biggest dream and what's the hardest dream for me? Music, because I'm not, like, natural at anything but singing. So if I can take a really difficult dream and I can manifest it, then I'm going to learn a lot in this lifetime about the journey of being, the journey of becoming, and what it takes, and, you know, all of that. So I mean, it's one thing to have people tell you that, you know, you can be what you want to be, that life can be what you wish for it to be, leap in the net will appear, all this stuff. That's one thing. But to actually do it and know that that net's going to appear, that's what I wanted to know. I wanted to know, will that happen? Because there were more secure paths that I could have taken, you know, but I wanted to put myself in the place where I'm, like, trying these things that are visions for me that don't really seem real. They live in an invisible world in my mind's eye, and I'm bringing them into fruition into the physical world. And why does it take so long for some things to manifest in the physical plane? Because, like, on the invisible plane, it's already here, but we live on Earth, and time is a huge matter here, and matter is a matter, and it takes form, you know, but it takes time for things to form here. I do think there's other planes where you can think something and it happens faster, but because we're on the physical plane, things happen in a physical time period, and it takes time. But understanding how a thought can manifest something, or understanding how to choose thoughts or focus energy on thoughts is something that comes with being on Earth. You can get really good at that. So when you are in a plane where thought creates form instantaneously, you're not creating things that are harmful for other beings, because you know how to choose thoughts that are going to be uplifting and vibrate with harmony with all of life and existence, not just here, but all throughout all of the ether in all forms, you know? So I just wanted to understand that. And I couldn't understand it until I embodied what a dream was.
That's so beautiful. I love that so much. So it sort of sounds like, in very short version, it's like, okay, let's make this be an experiment. Like, all right, like...
like, that is what it is. What it was.
Which is how I view life a lot of times. Like, you know, I'm like, okay, or an adventure. I'm like, oh, this is an experiment or an adventure, instead of like, oh no, if this doesn't happen, this whatever. Because yeah, the timing and all of that, there's a lot out of our hands. But I want to touch back to, you know, when I was starting to ask you about what made you go for it. And then you said, like, you know, like, oh, your body had to, like, stop you in order so you could end up then just focusing on music. It sounded like, instead of like, let me work four jobs and do this. So back to your mom telling you to get on that mat and do that stuff you do. and you, so you got your, and how long were you like not playing and stuff, like taken out? Because then you said you did start to get out to do shows and you could sit in a chair and play that. Like, how long was it that you ended up like not playing because of your body shutting down?
It was about 4 months of just being bedridden and crawling to the bathroom. And then after that 4 months, that's when she was like, can't take it anymore. And like, if I went to open a bottle, I was too weak. Like, I couldn't do this. Like, I couldn't hold things, you know, I was weak for a long time. And even past the 4 months, like walking up steps or things like that. And when I went into, when I found out that I had diabetes, I went in to work at the herb shop and the lady was like, you don't look good. And I said, well, I don't really feel good. I saw two of myself today. And she was like, we're closing the shop. And she took me to the Minor Med and they said, her blood sugar is out of the world. We're going to call an ambulance, take her to the emergency room. She said, I'll take her. And so she took me down to the emergency room and the lady was like, yeah, you got diabetes and you're going to have to start taking insulin and blah, blah, blah. All of that whole process was so expensive that the money that I had saved went to paying those bills. And so I would pay them very slowly because I called the hospital. I said, look, I can't work. I physically have no energy. I can barely talk to you right now. And I know I got these bills and y'all calling me, but I don't have it. And she said, well, what can you do? And I said, I can do $10 a month. And so that's what I did. I was close to having my money to make the record, but I wasn't about to spend that knowing that I was that sick and unable to work. And so I just paid it slowly over time. And when I got, you know, my first record deal, I just paid it all off.
And how, what, well, where did the first record deal come from? Like, yeah, what was that steps then to like getting back? You're forcing yourself to just sit and play a show for 30 minutes to record deal.
So sit and play for 30 minutes. And I had, before I got sick, I had gone to New York to participate in a mixture of Hungarian folk music with African-American folk music. And so they brought all these African-American folk artists from all over the world. And I mean, all over the country. And then Hungarian gypsy folk artists. And they put us all in this show at Symphony Space. And I met, the way that they found out about my music is just that I'd been playing in blues festivals and little southern joints, juke joints and stuff. And people started talking. And so John Forte and some famous people started to say, hey, there's a girl. She plays banjo and guitar. We should get her up here. She's a black folk artist. So they invited me for that. And when I went to that, I fell in love with one of the Hungarian musicians. And so as I was like totally, you know, sick and unable to keep this connection, it doesn't take me long to fall in love. I fall in love like so fast. I look at someone, I feel it, and I'm like, oh, I know you. And so I fell in love with them through that week of whatever it was. And so after I had enough strength and energy to get on a plane, I went to Budapest and I worked with some musicians over there. And I still been dreaming about making my record, but my money was running out because I had bills to pay. And so one friend said, you can do a Kickstarter campaign and you can make some of the money back that you had to spend to, you know, take care of the bills while you've been sick. And so I did a Kickstarter campaign and my fans gave me $15,000 and labels started calling me and they were like, hey, we want to work with you. And so I was like, looking for the right connections. And I met this guy, Kevin Agunis, and he flew into Memphis and took me out to dinner and was like, hey, I want to produce your record. And I had $15,000 to do it. And I said, well, that sounds good. And he said, and I want to sign you to my label. And I was like, I don't know about that part, but I definitely like the sound of you producing my record. He said, well, who would you like to write songs with? And I said, well, I like the Black Keys. I wouldn't mind working with Dan Auerbach because he's got a solo record and I really like it. And he said, well, Dan just moved to Nashville and I helped them put their studio together. So I'll give him a call and see if he wants to work with you. And so he sent Dan some of my bootlegs that I had been making in the bedroom and selling out the back of my trunk at these shows that I had before I got sick. And he liked my voice and the style. And so he was like, yeah, I'll work with her. Let's do some songwriting. So I went to Nashville, and our first songwriting session was at John Prine's studio in Nashville. And so we sat there and we wrote some songs, and then we had some dinner at his house one night, and he was like, would you like to make a record with me? And I said, well, yeah, but I already told Kevin, who hooked us up, that he could produce it. And he said, well, maybe we could co-produce it because I'm going to produce everything. I just finished a studio and I would like to have you be the first artist I record there. And I was like, okay, sounds good. So I went and I made the record there. And the Black Keys then, they didn't have their Grammys. They won all these Grammys shortly after I made that record with him. And so everybody was looking at them. And, you know, he played the record for people, and people started to hear that I had made this record with him. And a lady in Europe, she started sending it out to all these European labels. And so we landed a label deal in Europe, in the UK. And that was my first deal, and it was real money. And so I signed the deal, but I signed it only for the UK and Europe. And so all the rest of the world was open. And so when the record came out, it was doing really well. And, you know, like the States people who were kind of offering me very low offers and not really too invested in the kind of music that I was doing based on what I look like, they started to get interested. And I started seeing some real deals coming from the States. So I signed a deal in the States with my label that I'm still with now. So I had two deals, and they were both, you know, my first. And then the second record I put out with the Stateside label, and I've been with them since then.
And when was, what year was that that you signed those deals and did that album with Black Keys?
That was 2012 that the label deal happened, and the record came out 2013.
One more thing I have to make sure you know about: my drop in messages. I have been working to get you the magic that my private clients experience by working with me in a way that you can do it in an affordable way and that you can actually access it, apply it easily. So the drop-in messages come to a private podcast feed. Just like where you're listening to this podcast, you can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts, but it's not open to the public. 2 to 3 times a week, I give you drop-in messages that are short, powerful, compact. So you can listen to these on the go. You don't have to be sitting in front of a screen. You don't have to log in anywhere. Bam, they appear in your feed. And you also get an email every time a new one drops to remind you to go check it out. So these are half like pump you up, remember who the F you are messages, that you are here to be you, dropping the shame, whatever, getting out of your own way. And the other half are nudging you out of procrastination, busting through blocks to get those things done that you do want to do. I created these with the intention for them to be people who already are or want to be putting themselves and their work out in the world. But the reality is they are for you, because every single person ends up trying to hide who they are, forgetting what they want. What you might not have a dream that you want to activate and bust through procrastination about, but I'm sure you have a bajillion things on your just day-to-day list. So it will serve you no matter what. You join either for a monthly payment plan or pay in full, and you get access to the messages for 6 months. So all the new ones, all the old ones, and it's super cool because let's say, oh, you have something you're nervous before, you have a meeting or something. Let me pull up the drop-in feed and find one that's to boost my confidence, to remind me who I am. Maybe you're sitting in front of your computer and you're stuck about this thing that you want to be doing, but you're just stuck. Oh, let me open up the drop-in feed and find one of these procrastination busters. And again, these are things that are like 3 to 12 minutes long. It's not you have to sit in front of a 90-minute lecture. It is so easy for you to drop in and remember who the F you are and get out of your way. Check it out, yourjoyologist.com/drop-in.
So you've been out there making your music and touring and doing all the things for the last like 10 years. Yeah. And I want to get to, I'm so loving talking to you, but I of course want to talk about your new like book journal that is so amazing that's coming out. And I've, you know, been journal, personal development person, whatever, for a long time too. And yours is so different from so many things that I've seen. Just your language and how you're like pulling people into visuals. Like I didn't go through the whole thing, but just scanning and like some of the prompts of like, oh, you're out in public and like notice, like, I don't know, it seemed like so visual. Maybe it was just the ones that I was seeing. I kept landing on like really like calling yourself into the present moment in the surroundings. Where did it come from to even do this, to write, make this guided journal?
Well, I did the book Maps for the Modern World, and I was really influenced by Shel Silverstein and Rupi Kaur and writers like that who also illustrate and share their poems. And as a dreamer and a person who like sees and envisions things and works with the elements and the universe and all that is to manifest things, I just looked at the world and I was like, well, I kind of think that there are little ways that we can do meditations and have practices in our day that connect us with each other more, because a lot of the studying that I've done in that realm is very egotistical. It's very materialistic and selfish in some ways. And you kind of have to be very eye-centered. But to me, the eye is you seeing eye and all, you know, that you right there talking to me, Trisha, you are a form of me and I'm a form of you. We're one. Or that bug crawling on the wall, or the butterfly, or the bumblebee, or the compost, all being one. And so just coming and looking at the world, especially post-pandemic, and looking at ways we can use some of our individual, like we have so many masters on the planet that use their superpowers to manifest, but how do we use the same skills for personal manifestation to manifest a harmonious earth and a more peaceful world and more unity with each other? And so that's what inspired me to do the book, was like, what does it mean to be a badass self? Well, it's not just me out here doing my thing, think big and get rich, or get where I need to be, you know, stacking cash, doing my thing. It's me and all of existence, all of us learning how to treat the planet kinder and relate to the earth and see ourselves in a leaf. And so therefore, in turn, that's going to affect how I treat that tree or the ground that I'm walking upon, you know?
Or the person in line in front of you at the store, or in the car in front of you.
Right, exactly. And it's also, you know, when we go through so much as far as people every day, there's something dealing with race or poverty or, you know, sex, you know, gender related issues. And if we start to say, that's me right there. How am I treating myself there when I'm making this judgment about another being? Then I think the way we are relating becomes different. At least I hope.
Yeah, it's so true. When you were talking, And I'm someone who, like, one of my best friends used to, like, call me Sister Manifesta. And, like people are like, oh, you're such a great manifester in your life and this. And I'm like, yes. And also, like, I'm not someone that really resonates with that term, even though I do. Like, I'm just like, well, I mean, yeah, I thought about something and then I, like, made it happen. I showed up. Like, it just seems we can easily throw that term out there. Like, oh, just manifest it. And that's how it can often be, especially in the social media, you know, world, whatever. But those people and who are teaching these skills and that are empowering people, not to diss them in any way, but you're right, it is often focused on, like, manifest your dream life or this money or this. I never hear people talking about, like, manifesting better outside of yourself. Like, it's you, for your money, for your return, for your job, for your dream home and stuff like that. Like, that's how I'm often seeing it, really, is that that's what people are, like, wanting to manifest is for me, I. That I'm having more.
And I think that that's part of the journey, is it must start with you. So all those skills that we learn as we are, you know, dreaming and moving toward the dream home or the diploma or the degree or whatever it is, yes, go for that. But with we do it in the perspective of, how does this bring together the earth? How does it bring together all of humanity? How does it lift up many, many generations that will follow? You know, how does it create more harmony? And because what an individual, like I was talking about lifetimes, what I'm doing in this lifetime, also what an individual is learning in along their path, that's a tool that should benefit all of humanity in a positive way, or has the potential to. But if the perspective isn't shifted toward, okay, yes, I'm going to manifest my dream home and all of my amazing things in my life, but I'm doing that in turn to learn the skills of how to return that to all living beings. You know, it's not just for me, it's for all, that it keeps growing and changing and moving toward connecting all living beings for something sweeter and kinder. And so it does start when you're kissing somebody out in traffic and you're like, oh, that is not me right there. You know, no, no, no. Back it up. Take some breaths. How do you want to be treated in this situation?
That's funny, because that is where sometimes we'll all have to be like, yeah, I'll get frustrated because, yeah, like somebody stops suddenly or something like that. And then I'll be like, Trisha, like, you've never stopped since. Like, I'm always like, when I find myself like enraged and I'm like, okay, so you're acting like you've never done that before. Okay, no. Like, they're just driving. This is not a personal attack against me. They are like,
and I don't know what like they're going through today, you know. Like,
oh, and I loved in the, I don't know if it's like the intro or the beginning where you like, yeah, like say something like the badass in me sees the badass in you. I don't know if that's the right wording, but I know it's definitely the word badass, which I loved so much because I love that word.
Yeah, that's the badass respect mantra. You can just look at some strangers sometimes and you can just look them in the eye and be like, you got it. We're on the same page here. Let's see. I can turn to that part in the book. So that was one of the, there's all of these practices for taking your exercises that you might use in manifestation or meditations and bringing them into the world. And so this is the badass respect mantra for friendship and humanity. The badass in me respects and appreciates the badass in you. Although we see the world through different lenses, I honor your views and perspectives. Thank you for being. Thank you for sharing. I love to see you brightly shining. I love celebrating the diversity of our world and just feeling like that needed to be the tone of this coming election year. You know, we're not going to agree on everything, or, you know, I mean, we're so different and we come from so many backgrounds and we believe so many different things. But if we have this badass respect for each other, then we're going to be able to make it through without things like Charlottesville happening, you know? or January 6th. So I just look at it and I'm like, where's the tone and the temperature? And what is a writer or an artist or a musician's responsibility to keep the temperature down? Because I could get on Twitter and talk about how much I don't like this, that, or the other, or this person or the other person. But what kinds of temperature can I start to temper and cultivate around me? And it starts in very small communities in the same way that we were talking about any minute, any moment. It's the same with the energy that we're sharing. And it's not even sometimes words. It's the way we're relating to each other in the line or in the traffic or at the post office, you know?
No, I totally get that and feel that. That's so exciting. Are you so excited to have this almost? Well, yeah. Yeah. When this comes out, it'll be like out in the world or either like coming out in a couple of days. How does that feel? Because this is a different music. And even I know you did. Is it a children's book, the other book?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that was so cute. You should have seen all these little kids playing ukuleles because it's all about an instrument, but it's also about dreams. It's teaching them very young just to keep believing in what's possible, which then as they get older and with the shifts in the climate and stuff, like maybe they will keep the door open to dreaming and believing and calling it into being like Greta does, you know, a more healthy planet. But so that book, that was amazing. I put that one out with Jack White's Third Man Books, and it was so cool to have something out on his with his imprint. Because I love his music.
I didn't even know that he had a book imprint. It's a book imprint?
He does. He has Third Man Records and Third Man Books. And so he puts out all kinds of stuff of artists, but also, well, musicians, but also writers. So that came out with him. And then this one came out with Andrews McMill, or it comes on September 19th. And I'm doing workshops. One is going to be at Kripalu Health and Yoga Center. And then another one is combining some of the works in the book that were the exercises with songs for five things that you learn in five songs, which is coming up in their online workshops. But I can do ones in person too. I can go through the badass respect mantra with a group of cool people.
Love that. So exciting. Any other future? I mean, I'm guessing you're just really in this next big development, but yeah, like has creating this journal sparked any other different ideas in you as well?
Well, there are so many. I get downloads constantly of things that I want to create and do. And oh, it's just great to wake up in the morning and have the whole day as my canvas. Like, as far as I'm able to play music all day or write all day or dance all day. And that's a certain type of freedom that has come with the years. And so I definitely have a few other things in the cauldron that I'm working on, but I don't talk about the things until they're in my hands like this.
I get you. Very exciting. Yeah, I just wondered, you know, like this is it seems like, and not that I'm sure the children's book was such a different creative undertaking too, and then this one, but yeah, with so many different prompts and stuff that you have there, that I imagine like how much time, like, and energy put into this experience that you're creating for people. And so then, yeah, like what else that could have led you to, like, oh, what about this? I'm so excited. Okay, I'm going to ask you some of the questions that I ask everybody to wrap it up. The first one is, what do you do to raise your joy levels if you're maybe feeling bummed? And just like a little go-to to be like, all right, let me see if I can boost my mood.
Most days I wake up pretty low. So one way that I boost my levels is dancing. I dance for at least 10 minutes and I put on the music and I start getting down in the living room or hotel room, which I'm in a hotel most nights. at just getting down. And soon as I'm finished with 10 minutes, I look up, the clock's gone by, and I just been like dripping in sweat, and I'm happy. Like, so that's the biggest way that I shift my energy. But I also found, as I was cleaning houses, I started to do meditation in motion. And what I would do is, as I was dusting, like Karate Kid, wax on, wax off, I would say, thank you, Goddess, because I am now shining. Thank you, Goddess, because I am now shining. Thank you. Breathing in, breathing out. Thank you, because I am now glowing. Thank you, because I am now grateful. Thank you, because I am now radiant. Whatever it is, calling that I, the I being we and all. And I would do that times the hours that I was in houses, which was from 6 to about 4. And that would be on repeat. And I took that into when I was sick in the bed, but also when I got out and as I board a plane, as I go to play a show. It's like in my Christian upbringing, they say pray without ceasing. So I keep these words. I wrote all the words of joy down that I could, single words. And I do affirmations with those words constantly. Like I can be talking to you, but it's like da 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 in my mind constantly. And it elevates my energy, because otherwise my energy goes to what I saw on the news that might hurt me because I'm really sensitive, or something somebody said, or likes, or, you know, all of these things, what's happening on socials or whatever. And I'm like, wait a minute, retune. Da 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 da, with that mantra repeating. It's like the backtrack of my life.
I love that. Yeah. No, I've used mantras. And in fact, I ran a Kickstarter years ago to raise money for my first affirmation deck, which is called Own Your Awesome.
I want to be you.
Yeah. Like, like, yeah, because I love to use affirmations and mantra as like short circuit, or like, oh, if I feel myself being like, oh, I'm so frustrated, whatever, but like, okay, no, like, what am I telling myself? What do I want to tell myself? Like, that's how I can do it in the moment of like, yeah. So but I love how you phrase it as thank you. And so instead of like, I am glowing, which would be like traditional, I guess, affirmation writing or whatever, I'm glowing. Thank you, because I am now glowing. Like, I love that. Thank you. You know, even if like, oh, I'm nervous before this interview. Thank you, because I am now confident. Thank you, because I am now present. I make up that's how, like, because that's what I do. I try to use like, oh, I'm feeling nervous. How do I want to feel confident, at ease, this? So then I am at ease. I am present. But you would phrase it as thank you, because I am now. I love that.
Yeah, because to me, gratitude seals whatever deal you're making with the universe or your higher self. Gratitude seals it, because I don't necessarily, I mean, I use the word goddess, but it could be literally green tree. It can be whatever. But, you know, but there is always like that to me is connecting with the we, the all other beings, that because it takes everything to make us who we are, you know, the good, the bad, the beautiful, the ugly, all of it, and everyone that we get, we allow, it all allows us to be, and we allow it to be.
Yes. Okay. And next question is, I ask everybody to apply this phrase to their own life. What is easiest for you is not always what is best for you. So it might be like a way that you're naturally wired. What is easiest for me is blank. What is best for me is blank. And it doesn't necessarily have to be harder. It's just like, it's.
So that changes for me all the time. But I guess what's easiest for me is to push. What's hardest for me is to rest. And so I'm learning how to rest. But
that is an important
thing. I like pushing. I like it.
You got to go in cycles. Push cycle, rest cycle, push cycle, rest cycle. You don't have to give up on pushing, but let yourself go through some cycles. Okay, and the last question is, the name of the podcast is Claim It. This is mostly because I feel like so often people are searching for how they want to feel based on how it looks. Like, I'll be enough once, and it's like, once my life looks like this, once I have enough this, once I'll be successful, fulfilled, once I, And they're usually visualizing what they think that looks like instead of what does it feel like to be fulfilled? What does it feel like to be successful? What does it feel like to be enough? And when you actually like think about what does that feel like in your body, not what does that look like in my life or to other people, you can have pretty damn close access to claiming it in the now by focusing on what that feels like. Anyway, so that's one of the reasons the podcast is named Claim It. But the last question is, what are you claiming for yourself right now?
Wow.
No biggie.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, what am I claiming for myself right now? I think I am claiming an appreciation for where I am. Because as a pusher, there's always where I want to be. But then, like, you know, I like where I am is beautiful and it's small and it's great. And we always want to like be these big, whatever it is, or get to the top of whatever it is. But I'm like starting to really embrace tiny, fairy like, just iridescence in small things. And what does that look like to appreciate where I am and what I have and how far I've come and all the people that are around me right now? Because like, oh, I wish we could keep them forever in the same form, but doesn't it change? So just appreciation for where I am.
I love that. I have loved talking to you so much. Thank you for sharing yourself with us and for taking on that experiment all those years ago to try out, what would it be?
Yeah. What
to try out a dream. And then continue showing up.
No big deal. Thank you so much, Trisha. It was so wonderful talking with you. And I want to be you. So we have this. We have this trait.
All right. Wow. What a journey. What a story, right? Make sure to go get her book, order it for a friend, order it for some loved ones. Light Beams, a workbook for being your badass self. Link will be in the show notes. Go check out her music. Find her on social media, Valerie June. And of course, you know where to find me on social media, I hope. @_TrishaHuffman is my main account. I also have Your Joyologist. The podcast account is @ClaimItPodcast. Sign up for my daily text messages. I love sending these so much. Use code JOY3 to get $3 off the first 3 months. You can cancel at any time. So if you join and you're like, oh, okay, I love these and they're not for me or whatever, you can cancel and then you'll still get them for the rest of the month. You know, just like when you have a Netflix subscription, you cancel it and then it expires a month after you joined, right? If you cancel like that. Anyway, you can also get my drop-in messages. They come in a private podcast feed. They are short, they're compact, they are powerful to empower you to who you are. There's not my rambliness, direct tips, messages, little like sort of visualizations to drop you into who you are, to remembering to show up as you are, to get out of your own way. There's procrastination busters, tips, hacks, all the things. All right,